Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is attorney Liz Johnston in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we're discussing covering at work, what it is, how it's sabotaging diversity, equity, and inclusion plans, and the legal implications of your employees covering in the workplace. Liz, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think covering is an aspect of diversity that is, I don't want to say lesser known, but lesser discussed. And to me, one of the interesting things when you and I first discussed it was the fact that covering is something that is being experienced by all of our employees. It's not just a certain segment of our employee population that finds itself covering at some point during the course of their career. But this really is something that in many situations, all of us, and I'm going to include myself as well, cover some aspect of their personality at some point in time. So I'm really looking forward to spending, you know, the next hour with you, really jumping in and talking about both what covering is and how it's affecting different organizations' diversity and inclusion programs. But before we get there, I mean, oftentimes our listeners want to know, well, Tawny, why are you talking to Liz about this? What is it about Liz that, you know, means that you wanted to talk to her on the show about it? So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about you and the work that you've done presenting in the diversity and inclusion realm and on covering more generally?
Sure. So my practice at Verrill focuses on employment-related issues, and a large part of my practice is counseling employers about various issues in the workforce. And, you know, the goal is to have a workforce that works well together, is authentic, is dedicated to their job, and enjoys working there. And covering inherently relates to people being authentic, and that really is a key indicator, sort of in performance, retention, and also discrimination, you know, issues potentially. So talking about covering, I think, is really important to getting a better understanding of what's going on a deeper level with employees, and recognizing that there are steps we can take to help people feel more included in the workforce. And that potentially relates to a lot of employment-related issues. I do have a background in psychology before I became a lawyer, and I really enjoy sort of the issues related to that as well.
So Liz, we've now used the term covering multiple times. Can you tell our listeners what covering is?
So covering is essentially people covering a certain aspect of themselves that might relate to sort of a stigmatized or a stereotypical part of who they are. So sort of downplaying aspects of themselves that might be associated with general stereotypes about certain groups, such as people with disabilities, gender, age, various groups that might have stigmas attached, and you know, unconscious and sometimes conscious efforts to prevent traits in themselves related to those groups from being apparent at work.
Are employees doing this to be malicious or to, you know, be destructive in some way? Ha ha, I'm not going to tell my employer X, Y, and Z, and therefore covering that aspect of themselves?
Definitely not. You know, some employees might not realize they're covering, but even those that do, this is not a malicious thing or an intent to hide anything necessarily to hurt their employer. Really what this is it's related to a feeling that they need to cover these aspects themselves in order to advance or fit in with their peers or develop professionally. So that's more what these efforts are geared toward rather than anything malicious.
So when we're talking about covering, it sounds to me that culture plays a big role in these things that employees may potentially want to hide, and whether or not that is the culture of your organization or the culture in the community in which you work in. And when I say community, I mean the geography, the United States work culture, all of those different aspects are going to play a role potentially, based off of what you're saying, into what people choose to cover and what they don't choose to cover, correct?
Absolutely. You know, it really depends on the workplace culture, as you mentioned, and that differs from employer to employer, based on geography, based on the makeup of the community, based on the job itself. So different workplaces and different areas could, you know, potentially result in different types of covering. You know, we might see covering show itself differently in a manufacturing atmosphere rather than a corporate atmosphere based on what's perceived to be important and what is perceived that is less important to advancement there. So people might cover differently in different atmospheres based on how they're feeling.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Liz Johnston at Beryl. And we're discussing covering at work, what it is, how it's sabotaging diversity and inclusion plans, and the legal implications of covering in the workplace. So Liz, now that I and our listeners all have this understanding of what covering is generally, are there different types of covering, or is everyone doing it the same way? Is it, I don't want to say the bandwagon effect where we're all covering similar information. What types of things do we need to know more specifically about covering?
Sure. So there's actually four different types of covering. And a lot of the information we're talking about today comes from something called the Deloitte study, which was done a number of years ago. But it's a really great resource for better understanding covering and the different types. And, you know, from that study, there's really four specific categories of covering. That's appearance-based, affiliation, advocacy, and associational covering. And all of those relate to different characteristics, different types of ways that we cover based on, you know, from how we dress to how we interact with others, to how we might alter certain personality traits or show personality traits associated with a certain group.
So I definitely want to get into exactly like what you mean when you say appearance and affiliation. But even before we get there, before you and I scheduled this taping, I mean, you gave me a copy of the Deloitte study, and I was fascinated that the study shows that we have 61% of our workforce indicating that they're covering in some fashion in the workplace. Is this just a phenomenon that we see in the workplace, or is it a larger phenomenon where historical figures have covered, or politicians or other people who are in the public light are also covering in some way?
Absolutely. This is something that's gone on for a really long time, so it's certainly by no means a new phenomenon or just limited to the workplace. You know, we can look at FDR, for example, who's in a wheelchair, and, you know, we see that he would not be photographed in a wheelchair as often, or, you know, at least attempt not to, in order to try and minimize the appearance of having a disability. So we see it in prominent figures, as well as just day-to-day life where you have somebody who might restrict themselves from using a cane as much as they need to because they're trying to appear a certain way to others.
Is covering only something that that it's your understanding that people are explicitly choosing to do, or some of it, could it be so ingrained that they're implicitly covering, that they're covering without recognizing or realizing that it's something that they're doing for advancement within their organization?
Definitely, I think this often will exist below the surface. Some of these stereotypes and stigmas that are associated with different groups are things that people have grown up with and have seen in their community for their whole lives. So having that exposure might create, you know, sort of a really ingrained feeling of the need to cover. They might not even recognize on a personal level.
Let's jump in, Liz, and talk about some of these different forms of covering. You said that the one of the initial ones that one might learn about is appearance covering. What is appearance covering?
Sure. So appearance-based covering relates to how individuals present themselves to others. So, you know, this can be both in appearance, but it can also be personality or mannerisms that people use or cover or adjust in order to better blend in and fit in. So we use the example of FDR, and that was an example of covering disability. But, you know, people have also, in the Deloitte study, admitted to covering their personality traits or wearing certain clothes to appeal more masculine in a corporate workplace, modeling behavior after the opposite gender in order to appear more masculine to advance. So it really can be anything related to how you're presenting yourself to other people.
I found it really interesting when I was going through the survey, because in my mind, it helped me to recognize times and ways in which I have covered, whether it's at work or just in society more generally. And specifically, I laugh because over the course of the last, say, 3 to 5 years, it definitely has been since my wonderful ball of joy that is my daughter joined my life. But the white hairs just keep on coming and making the choice as to whether or not I hide those white hairs from the public or I let them shine, I think has become a really interesting question. And in reading about appearance-based covering, it was one of those interesting aspects where it talked about heterosexual males who choose to dye their hair in order to look younger than they really are. I mean, while we talk about different avenues or ways in which people are covering, this is something that goes to cultural aspects, I think, that are not taken for granted, but that don't appear out of the norm in any sense. Oh, you dyed your hair because you don't like the incoming grays. Okay. But am I covering for a larger reason at work because I don't want to appear older or because I don't want people to think, you know, I am my true age? Is that something that the research is kind of showing that we need to be concerned about, Liz? Or what does it matter if I dye my hair or if I don't dye my hair?
You know, things like that are tailored to outward appearance, you know, with dyeing hair or wearing, you know, makeup or wearing certain type of clothes to try to fit in. It's important because it does, you know, relate to these ingrained perceptions and stereotypes about certain groups. But, you know, a lot of covering might be masked in what could appear to be personal preference. So I think, you know, it is a balance of what somebody feels most comfortable in or how they feel most comfortable, but it's important to just recognize why we're engaging in those behaviors generally. So, you know, it's not necessarily an inherently bad act to do something like dyeing gray hair, of course, but being aware of covering and sort of the more underlying reason for that, I think is important.
We're gonna take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Let me ask you a question. How do you feel about genetically modified ingredients?
Don't like them.
Artificial flavors and colors?
No thanks.
Clean ingredients.
Now that I like.
When you care about what's in things and what's not, shouldn't your vitamins be clean too? Sundown Vitamins are all clean all the time. Non-GMO, free of gluten and dairy, with colors and flavors from real food. We even have USDA certified Sundown Organics and kids vitamins too. When you're living clean, choose clean with Sundown Vitamins at supermarkets, drugstores, or on Amazon.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
Spring is in full swing, and there's no better time to freshen up your home than right now. Blinds.com is giving you up to 35% off everything site-wide as a warm welcome to a new season. Blinds.com makes it so convenient to order online with free shipping and a guaranteed perfect fit for your windows. Whether you DIY or have them handle the install from start to finish, you really can't get it wrong. Next time you open your windows to let in that warm spring breeze, you'll love the views when you have brand new custom window treatments to enjoy. Whether you're looking for high-performance solar and roller shades, the classic silhouette of a Roman shade, or want to enhance your home with the warm textures of bamboo shades, Blinds.com will help you get a stunning new look this season. Visit Blinds.com right now to shop their new deals perfect for your spring home refresh with up to 35% off everything from blinds, shades, interior shutters, and even outdoor shades. Rules and restrictions may apply.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Liz Johnston in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. And today we're discussing covering at work, what it is, how it's sabotaging diversity and inclusion plans, and the legal implications of covering in the workplace. Before the break, Liz and I were talking about what covering is. Generally, we know that it is when an employee or an individual more generally kind of chooses to either minimize, downplay, or hide a certain aspect of their personhood. And we started talking about the different types of covering that's at play. And Liz pointed out the fact that we have four different forms of covering. And we started our discussion on appearance-based covering. Liz, the next type of covering that you mentioned was something called affiliation covering. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit more about what affiliation covering is and maybe give us a little bit of an example there?
Absolutely. So affiliation-based covering is when individuals avoid engaging in certain behaviors that are widely associated with their identity or their group to negate stereotypes about that identity. So an example of this might be that a woman might avoid talking about being a mother because she doesn't want her colleagues to think that she's less committed to her work. So in that sense, she's distancing herself from that family role and that, you know, the perceptions and stigmas that might be associated with that, as well as her gender. Another example of affiliation-based covering, again, from the Deloitte study is, you know, a respondent indicated that they try to stay away from work tasks that are stereotypical of Asians, which is, you know, their group, such as math assignments or math-based work, to avoid being categorized with that group and reduce the stigma associated.
So when we're talking about this affiliation covering, one of the things that comes to top of mind with this topic is the idea of affinity groups. So We know that affinity groups are something that a lot of workplaces have attempted to create in order to help individuals who either want to focus their diversity or inclusion efforts on a certain group of people. And that while you have an affinity group, it doesn't mean that only people who are able to identify with the affinity group in question are able to join, but instead people who believe that it is important or should be a focus of attention for a group that falls within either a minority status or a status that may experience issues in the workplace that are different from the norm. And we've seen parenting groups from this standpoint. We've seen different organizations based off of LGBTQ+ or based off of race or ethnicity. If individuals are covering and they're covering their affiliation, do you think that this plays a role in whether or not those affinity groups are successful in the workplace, Liz?
Absolutely. You know, sometimes affinity groups, employers aren't successful for this reason, because of covering both affiliation-based as well as association-based, which we'll talk about later, but that relates to individuals wanting to avoid contact with other group members, you know, again, to avoid being put into that group. So when we have affinity groups, you know, it can be a helpful tool to build that community of inclusion. But at the same time, if people are covering, which according to the Deloitte study, 40% of respondents indicated that they'd engaged in affiliation-based covering. You know, when we have a large group of people who are doing that, it might mean that they're not actively participating in an affinity group because they are not wanting to be affiliated or associated with others in their group.
It's interesting as well, because in the Deloitte study, I found that there were aspects of covering that was different from what an individual may expect. I mean, I think we think of covering as it being really something that's based only on falling within some protected classification. And I mentioned earlier, like, you know, heterosexual white men who are covering. But another one that I found really interesting in this section, and one of the respondents had reported, was an individual who said that they cover their age, and they cover their age for not wanting to draw attention to the fact that they're younger. And the individual said, "I am hesitant about taking time off during the day to attend doctor's appointments or taking extended PTO. I feel that being a younger practitioner, I have not earned that type of flexibility." To me, that says a lot about an organization's culture. So this idea that one must cover has to be coming from some place within the organization. And I know we've talked about different forms of PTO plans, unlimited PTO or limitations on PTO or state or federal mandated paid leave. Do you think that a culture can shift or change in such a way that individuals will cease covering, or that some of these concerns won't be either at the top of mind or even hidden by certain employees?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think workplace culture is a huge contributor to people covering or not covering. And so I noticed that specific example you gave as well. And I think it is so important because it shows that, you know, as you mentioned, this isn't restricted just to protected classes. This is related to other aspects of workplace identity. And I think, you know, opening the discussion is really the key. And if a workplace does open that discussion and does recognize that this type of behavior is occurring and how it might present itself in a particular workplace, then we can start addressing some of those issues and what might be present in the culture that causes somebody to feel this way.
Liz, let's jump on. The affiliation covering, I think, is so interesting and has a lot of ways in which we could continue to discuss it. But I know that there's still two other forms of covering that we haven't touched on yet. What's advocacy covering?
So advocacy covering relates to how, you know, how or the degree to which individuals are sticking up for a others in a group. So how they're reacting to potentially, you know, negative comments or negative attributions to others who might be in their same class of any sort. So an example of this might be where somebody hears somebody else in the workplace telling jokes about, you know, people with disabilities or something. And an individual with a disability who's engaging in advocacy-based covering might not say anything or do anything to stop that behavior. So it's really, you know, not standing up for the trait that is being covered.
Interesting, because in my mind, I mean, sirens, red flags, everything that as a lawyer identifies risks for me in the workplace is going off right now. And all I can think about is you have anti-discrimination, you have an anti-harassment policy within your workplace. And so often by the time you or I see a case, Liz, come to find out there's been a whole host of inappropriate conduct or activities that have taken place, but no one's ever reported it. I mean, does covering explain in some ways why we might not be seeing all bad actors being reported within a work environment?
Oh, absolutely. And this definitely raised red flags for me for that reason as well. You know, it comes down to people who are engaging in advocacy-based covering might not feel comfortable or like they can raise these issues. You know, another way that this type of covering can present itself, an example from the Deloitte study was that somebody tries not to make gender an issue. And so they don't, if they see gender bias going on in hiring decisions, they don't say anything. So, you know, this type of covering affects more than just the person who's engaging in it. You know, we have people that aren't speaking up when they're hearing these issues go on in the workplace. We have people who aren't speaking up when they see potential biases going on. So all of that definitely can increase legal risk. And it could be a reason that we're not seeing people making the reports that could, you know, mitigate that risk and stop the behavior from happening.
For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Liz Johnston in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. We've been discussing covering at work and the legal implications of covering in the workplace. You know, Liz, it's so interesting because while covering is something that we don't talk a lot about, I think it plays a very key role in a lot of the retaliation claims, the failure to report claims that we're seeing. Oftentimes people will indicate to us that while they have either experienced or witnessed some form of harassing or discriminatory conduct, that they don't report it because they're nervous about retaliation. And we know that retaliation and retaliatory behavior is very culture focused, but additionally, kind of these other sociological, psychological aspects that are related to covering further explain why I think individuals may be less likely to report inappropriate behavior as well. So we've now talked about advocacy covering, affiliation covering, appearance-based covering. The last one that you had mentioned was associational covering. What's associational covering?
Association covering is where individuals try to avoid contact with their other group members to, you know, again, avoid being stigmatized or stereotyped on the basis of those traits. So one way that this might present itself, just as an example, is in women who are afraid to sponsor or mentor other women because they're afraid to be seen as, you know, only sponsoring or mentoring other women. We could see it in people who decline to bring their plus one to work events if they're part of the LGBTQ community because they don't want to be, you know, affiliated or labeled as such. So it's really about who we are associating with, both in our personal lives and professional lives, and how we might perceive that others are perceiving us based on those associations.
One of the things that I found really telling about the Deloitte study was how it focused a lot on mental and physical health within the associational covering aspect of the report. And it's interesting because as lawyers, I mean, Liz, you and I are both attorneys. And one of the things we hear a lot of is the fact that one in five attorney likely will develop alcoholism at some point during the course of their career or is an alcoholic. But it's something that we don't talk about. It's that, I don't want to say elephant in the room, but people don't identify as alcoholics. They don't talk about the role that alcohol plays in their life. And similarly, as individuals with high stress jobs, and most of our listeners are in similar positions, in positions that are high stress, fast output, expectations are ever-changing and always high, the rate of depression in the workforce is also high. But you don't hear people in senior leadership positions or roles talking about alcoholism or depression or the role that these concepts, ideas, diseases play within their life. And I found, as I learned more about associational covering within this report and actually doing some additional research on it, that it made sense when we talked about cultural aspects of our society and specifically more about the work environment. I guess, because I am just talking, Liz, and I haven't asked you a question yet, but specifically, I mean, are there ways in which you think a work environment can become open or create a culture where stuff such as mental health and relationship with drugs and alcohol can be more openly discussed?
Yeah, that's such a great point, Tawny, because, you know, mental health in particular and, you know, and things like alcoholism are such ongoing and increasing problems in the, you know, on a national level. And they're just not being talked about enough. And the conversation is starting to open up, but it's definitely not where it should be. So we have individuals who are struggling. And like you said, we might never know because the issue is just not talked about. So I think, you know, providing a work environment where people do talk about these issues and express an empathy and an understanding of these issues and programs for employees to get help they need, focusing work events on inclusive activities that, you know, maybe not a happy hour out at the bar so that we're isolating people who have issues with alcohol problems and creating events that are inclusive and that people can participate in without having to worry about a mental or physical disability.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
We asked kids what it took to be a dad. This is what they had to say.
A father is always present. I mean, what real father figure can you have if they're not there?
In order to be a good dad, you need to love your son. You need to put gas in your car so you don't break down in the middle of nowhere. And you need to make them breakfast. Yep.
I mean, just to maybe play like a board game with me, or to just stay home and play some video games with me. Just to do like that one little thing is what I really look forward to.
I'm not asking him to be a perfect dad, but he should try.
He's just a constant force in my life.
There's no other type of love like a dad's love because it's not comparable to anything else.
Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
I'm Chris Riccobono, founder of Untuck It. We started Untuck It because we couldn't find shirts that look good untucked. That's why we created the perfect untucked shirt so guys can look sharp and feel casual. Untucked shirts fall at just the right length. We have 50 fit combinations, so tall, short, slim, and bigger guys of all ages can look great in untucked shirts. Try the original untucked shirt at one of our 55 untucked stores or at untucked.com.
Use the promo code FALL for 20% off your first purchase.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Guys, when you buy your clothes at DXL, you look good. But you feel like a rock star. So if you want to look and feel like a... You'll find all the brands you love, waist size 38 and up, all in one awesome store. DXL, you're looking good. Right now, Harbor Bay long sleeve tees are just $29.99 each when you buy two or more.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Liz Johnston at Verrill, and we're discussing covering at work. What it is, how it's sabotaging diversity and inclusion plans, and the legal implications of covering in the workplace. Liz, before the break, you and I were talking about associational covering, and we got specifically into a discussion regarding how often individuals at work cover mental health issues or issues with substances, including alcohol. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners were saying, wait a second, Tawny and Liz are attorneys, and here they are saying that they want people to talk more about protected classes and disabilities. And if we have everyone talking about those things, aren't we going to have ADA and FMLA concerns? Liz, is there a way that we can effectively help employees not cover but not run afoul of the ADA or the FMLA?
We really want to create an environment here where people feel comfortable talking about their own struggles, their own disability, if they want to. So that's sort of the key. And then if we have employees who do want to share their experience, and then that could potentially be a resource for other employees who are going through a similar experience. The goal here, you know, really is to, again, build that inclusive atmosphere rather than a culture where people feel they have to be isolated, even if they may not want to. And that said, you know, Tawny, this does, of course, raise implications with potentially accommodating disabilities when we become aware of them, offering leave that might be protected if we become aware that leave might be required for a disability. So definitely need to be aware of all of those other responsibilities of an organization when these conversations begin to happen.
One of the things that I found really interesting when I was reading more about covering was about FDR and FDR and how often he was covering his physical disability. And there was a discussion, and it was a much broader why question or how. And it was, how would the differently abled movement have changed if FDR hadn't covered his disability, if he had been having discussions about it and not covering it, would that have changed the course of, I don't want to say the course of history, but how would that have changed kind of the rights and obligations of individuals who are differently physically able in the long run? And I think that becomes a really interesting question, and one that's a much larger societal question as we talk generally and specifically about covering. So Liz, you know, we've now talked about the four different types of covering, and when we've done all the marketing for this program, we've said we're also going to talk about how it's adversely affecting diversity and inclusion programs. I mean, We've talked about it a little bit as we've talked about each of the different aspects of covering, but how does this relate, or how could it be sabotaging diversity or specifically inclusion efforts?
Yeah, so I mean, when we talk about diversity and inclusion efforts, you know, really the key here is inclusion. And to be included, people need to feel that they're being authentic. They need to be authentic, because we can't, if people are covering parts that are inherently part of their sense of self, it's hard to have an environment that's inclusive or make people feel inclusive, because they're, you know, fundamentally already separate from that by covering. And this is really, I think, a key thing to understand, is that, you know, according to the Deloitte study, over 60% and up to 73%, depending on the type of covering that's going on, you know, the people who were covering said that it was somewhat to extremely detrimental to their sense of self. And so when that's going on, and we have people that feel that they aren't being themselves, or that they are struggling because of this, it makes it difficult to have a work environment that's inclusive, just because you don't have the population that's ready to be part of that.
It's interesting, because a big part of your and my job is talking about business cases. What's the business case for X, Y, and Z course of action? What decreases risk in the greatest possible way, with either the least effort or at the least price? And some of those discussions. And as you and I have been talking about covering, you know, even prior to today, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that there is this Kellogg study at Northeastern that talks about the fact that individuals who have multiple persona, who have their work persona, who have their social group, their like their book club and their out with friends persona, and then who maybe have a parental figure persona when they're with their children or their family, that individuals in your workforce who don't have those different personas all intertwined kind of together as one personhood are more likely to, I don't want to say commit fraud, but to lie and to act unethically if the opportunity presents itself. So not only are we looking at some of these cultural aspects that you've discussed, but we're also looking at, okay, if we have people who aren't telling the truth because they're covering for one reason or another, because the small, I don't want to say lies, but the small coverings turn into bigger coverings or failure to report improper behavior. I mean, you have a much larger business problem here, correct?
Absolutely. You know, exactly as you said, and especially with the reporting and the feeling of being honest with an employer, you know, covering while itself isn't malicious and it's not necessarily intentional, it is, you know, changing a sense of somebody's presentation. And so when we have that change, it could lead to, as you said, covering in other aspects of the workplace and of the job. And that lack of authenticity and that lack of honesty, whether intentional or non-intentional, can definitely bleed over, and then you run into a whole host of other issues.
So in addition to just the general business operations, I mean, we have so many clients and listeners who are expending a ton of effort lately on diversity, on having a more diverse pool of applicants, on hiring a more diverse group of employees, but simultaneously, by not focusing on inclusion, by not understanding how some of these larger societal constructs may be sabotaging their inclusion efforts, they're doing themselves a disservice, because, I mean, I don't want to say that they're hamsters running around in a wheel, but they're definitely not gaining traction or movement forward during the course of the creation of these types of policies. And I so appreciate you coming on the show and giving everyone some background about all these different forms of covering. with that, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Man, do I love card night. You ready, boys? You got a king?
Go, Fish Dad!
Oh, come on! This is WWE superstar Titus O'Neil. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Connie Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Liz Johnson in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. We've spent today's show discussing covering at work. We've spent some time discussing what it is and how it's sabotaging diversity, equity, and inclusion plans. We've also discussed the legal implications of covering in the workplace, how it interrelates with retaliation claims, harassment, discrimination, and employees' general failure to report in a lot of situations. You know, Liz, you and I are wonderful and amazing at identifying risk and talking about those risks. But I think one of the things you and I enjoy most is helping or trying to offer some solutions. Is there a solution to covering?
Yeah, so I can't say I have the one solution that will solve covering issues, but I do have some suggestions on how you can take this back to your organization and potentially begin to work on the issue. So, you know, really, now that you have this understanding of what covering is, why it's important, both for in, you know, a specific employee sense is also a general business sense, you know, now what? And I think the first step really is to open that discussion in your organization and also take some time to self-reflect. Recognize, you know, that covering could be something you're engaging in identifying how, sharing this information with your management teams and your leadership, and also, you know, opening the door for that conversation with them so that they can recognize this in themselves and in their employees. You know, that's really the first step here when we're focusing on covering. And then really taking that, looking at the workplace, the culture, seeing whether there's aspects of your culture, your policies, your practices where they could potentially be resulting in people covering, and giving employees an opportunity to learn about this issue, self-reflect in it, and then potentially making adjustments as needed to open up those avenues for people to have a discussion.
I think it's interesting because there's a lot of aspects of inclusion that requires vulnerability from individuals in positions of leadership. And I believe it's something that we don't talk enough about. If you want to be successful and have a successful diversity and inclusion program, authenticity and vulnerability are such key and important aspects of it. As leaders, we don't have all the answers. We can't foresee every way in which a plan or a course of action may go astray. Our goal or our hope is that we've planned to the best of our ability, but being honest and vulnerable about capacity, about past behaviors, about who you are and what your limitations are, I think is something that we as a general society in the United States maybe don't focus on enough. Admitting and accepting failure and talking about the fact that, you know, you're going to make mistakes. It's human to err. And if you are not making mistakes here, you're likely not trying hard enough. Or if you are not making mistakes and your boss just doesn't think you're making mistakes, you most likely are, but they're being hidden in some format. I laugh because growing up, my grandmother would always say, no one's perfect except for me. She was doing it in jest, but I think it was an important lesson for us to understand that vulnerability, accepting and acknowledging that perfection is not the standard, is so important. And I think would do a great deal to help us help our employees uncover. Liz, any parting thoughts? I mean, I appreciate you coming on and having these, you know, big conversations about a really tough issue.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Tani.
Thank you to all of our listeners. And with that, you've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for the HR Tip of the Week.
And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, this is Doug Currier from Verrill. Today, I want to talk for a moment about workplace investigations. There obviously is a lot to think about when conducting an investigation, way too much to cover in the next minute. But I want to share five key principles, all of which seem obvious, but all too often are forgotten. First, treat every claim, however frivolous it may appear, as potentially having merit until proven otherwise. Second, keep an open mind during the investigation, disregarding all stereotypes. The bottom line is it can be shocking what some people will do. Third, it is important that the investigation avoid the appearance of being either a witch hunt or a whitewash. Fourth, it's important that both the accuser and the accused be given a full opportunity to tell their side of the story. And finally, fifth, it's important to examine every relevant piece of evidence that either the accuser or the accused suggests needs to be considered. Don't make assumptions. To further discuss what to do when conducting an investigation, please contact a member of Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.